Hi, it's Adam. Just before we begin this week, in case you didn't hear the episode live, we were interrupted a couple of times by an Amber Alert for a child that was taken in Mississauga. Fortunately, that child was found about an hour and a half, 2 hours later in Chatham, Kent. But as we were on the air on Thursday, the Amber Alert went out twice, which is why when you listen to topics 2 and 3, they end kind of abruptly, so just keep that in mind as you're listening to this week's episode. Good afternoon, everyone. Welcome to Open Sources Guelph here on CFRU 93.3 FM, CFRU.ca, Guelph Campus and Community Radio. I am Adam A. Donaldson of Guelph Politico, and joining me is...
Scotty Hertz, all the swears out of my system and ready to go.
Oh man, you should have heard it. It's like a Two Live Crew concert in here.
It kind of exploded out, but that means, you know, we'll have a clear hour, I think, a good shot at it. If not, I'll apologize in advance, even though that's not how we roll, but...
we don't roll with apologizing.
The air was blue, and we don't even smoke.
I don't know what that means.
Oh.
Anyway.
I got 10 years on you, Donaldson. That's probably why I said.
Open Source is a CFRU's political and current affairs discussion show, and you can find us here every Thursday at 5 p.m. as we talk about the latest news items from Guelph, Ontario, Canada, and around the world. And sometimes we interview local newsmakers and politicians. But today we are going to be talking about the results of the Alberta election, which, as predicted, saw Jason Kenney win a complete majority, so we'll talk about the political fallout for the Wild Rose province and what this election might portend for this false federal election. Mm-hmm. And then we will come back to Ontario and look at what's going on with the Ford government, which is looking to amalgamate ambulance services and cut money from local public health units and slash flooding funds in half.
And community radio
stations. Just in time for floods. Yeah, so that's awesome. And then finally, we look at the release of the Mueller report and talk about what Democrats should do next and the internal question of whether or not they should impeach. But first, there was another provincial election this past Tuesday. It was in Prince Edward Island, and it was historic, but just not in the way people were hoping or expecting. certain green-colored people, shall we say, although I don't think we could mitigate the fact that there is now a legislature in Canada where the Green Party sits as the official opposition.
Pretty amazing stuff, eh? Mm-hmm. And of course, we talked about it a couple of weeks ago and a couple of times that all the polling was suggesting the Greens were going to sweep it. It was sort of true. I mean, they obviously didn't become the government, but this is unprecedented stuff. It was just Peter Bevin Baker, the leader for... Actually, he was only just a one-termer, wasn't he?
Mm-hmm.
And I'd heard that he had run in various capacities like 10 times.
Yeah. No, he's had to run multiple times. I mean, like a lot of green people, you have to sort of, you know, Mike Nagy here ran 3 times before mm-hmm. he came in third in 08. So, yeah, this is sort of the path of the green, the hardcore green political candidate is that you have to run multiple times to build that name recognition.
Oh, for sure. It sounds like he's a well-liked individual. And I heard that on the campaign trail, he fixed somebody's tooth on the campaign trail. So that's going to win you some points.
He pulled a Sanjay Gupta.
Yeah. So this was definitely a three-way race. It wasn't... Mm-hmm. PEI has a long history since Confederation, supposedly of electing the Conservatives for 3 rounds, then the Liberals for 3 rounds, then they would go back. I think it sounded like with one exception, that's how PEI rolls. This mm-hmm. has changed the calculus completely. And we have a hung parliament as well. So this, mm-hmm. they've said, technically it's a PC government, but realistically it's a minority government. And interestingly, I heard King. Is it Dennis King?
Yeah.
Dennis King was also saying along the lines of Peter Bevin Baker that he was willing to collaborate. He said he's not pro carbon tax. Mm. He's pro same-sex marriage. It's coming from a conservative person. And I was like, I think the conservatives were hoping for the blue sweep. I did see one map of like, this is what the provinces look like now. It's just blue Canada with a couple of exceptions.
It's like the last 5 provincial elections have gone blue. Although the point has been made that Being a progressive conservative in PEI is not the same as being a conservative in Ontario or Alberta.
Well, it's kind of like being a liberal in BC means being a conservative, right? Yeah. Realistically.
Yeah. Right. Yeah.
And they had a... It's not exactly parity. Would they say that five women elected?
Five women
up
of
from
the
zero.
Eight.
I guess just there, well, there was none
the,
or one.
The one woman wrote her name. Hannah Bell. Hannah Bell was the second Green MLA elected, and that was in a by-election situation.
Right.
So her and Peter Bevan Bacon had nice offices. I assume they were nice offices, but they were in the basement of the PEI legislature. Hopefully now they get to move upstairs.
To get to keep their stapler? Yeah. it's my stapler.
Swing line,
it's
baby.
Green stapler.
Yeah, no. But, yeah, so, yeah, five of the eight are women, which is pretty extraordinary in its own right that, you know, you have a majority caucus of women. But, I mean, again, we don't want to overestimate the impact.
No.
Because it is PEI. It is a 27-seat legislature.
And one seat's still open.
One seat's still open because of, yeah.
The death of Josh Underhay and his son in a canoeing accident left, I think they're calling it District 9, is still open. They were able to vote for the referendum, which we will talk about, but they weren't allowed to vote for a candidate. I guess there is a section in the rules for when that happens because it was just days before, wasn't it?
It was on the weekend, yeah.
And I happened to catch a little bit of Bevan Baker's victory speech. And of course, it started off on a really sad note. It's the absolute worst, especially in a smaller place like that where everybody does. I don't know if you've ever been. Have you been to PEI? Or?
No.
I've been to PEI. I went to U of PEI for part of a term. We won't get into it, but.
Is that where the blue smoke was?
Yeah. I was surprised that everybody seemed to know who, even though I just showed up, everybody knew who I was and what I was doing. And it's like a province, but it's also like a small town into itself. So really nice place. Just don't go there to school in January. But anyway, enough about me. I wouldn't mind being there now. That's
Wow. That's
what the heck was that?
I hope PEI Tourism like takes that for their next campaign. Wouldn't want to be there in January, but you could be there now.
Yeah. And don't stay in the Garden Province Motel. But anyway, back to the election. It's probably not there anymore. Probably burnt down.
Doesn't help.
Where are we going with this? The green surge. Yes. So as we know, the show must go on, man. The polls were incorrect, but it's historic. It's historic regardless. And of course, who did I hear on the radio more than once? Some guy named Mike Schreiner talking about this victory. Mm-hmm. So the wave is definitely spreading.
It's a compelling story, and I guess if there's like a party with like momentum going into the federal election, you can make the argument that the Conservative Party has momentum with, you know, all the chips falling through the center of the country. But we have to remember that it took Stephen Harper three tries to get a majority government and one try to just, you know, make him a name for himself as the Conservative leader and as the Prime Minister in waiting. So, I mean, things look better for Andrew Scheer right now than they do for Justin Trudeau. But in terms of like actual momentum, as in terms of like getting people excited to vote for a party, I think it's with the Green Party because you have PEI now, you have Mike here, you have the potential results of Nanaimo Ladysmith next week, I want to say, May 6th. So a week from...
Yeah, that's right. I think that's
a week from Monday.
Yeah.
So
soon enough, we'll know.
Soon enough. And if that's like another victory for the Green Party, with the NDP not, you know, having a lot of energy, that transfer, that progressive vote could very well go to the Green Party. But I mean, I don't want to like overhype that too much again because we're talking about PEI. It's an interesting sort of control province that this is going to get taken for a ride. And if there was a, I was going to mention this later when we were talking about Ontario stuff, but there was the Martin Cohen article about Mike, where he's like
glowing.
Glowing about how Mike is a refreshing voice. This may be almost an exact quote of the headline, but a refreshing voice at Queen's Park, refreshing or respectful or something like that. But if, you know, we see that idealistic green influence actually having influence, that is pretty powerful. That might actually represent a real shift. And to get into the referendum part, mm-hmm. because electoral reform is one of the main planks of every green platform, they're going to have to do it from the inside. They're going to have to get into the halls of power and do it from the inside because, I said it before and I'll say it again. Democracy doesn't work. No, referendums don't work. But,
and that's the end of our show, folks.
I mean, we've seen that in BC. Yeah. We've seen that in PEI now, where they've had multiple electoral reform elections, and each time it gets worse and worse and worse for those people who are pushing electoral reform.
But this was close. It's where they set the bar. So in this case, it was supposed to be a simple referendum, 50% plus one.
But they had to win 17 writings.
17 writings of the 27.
Seven.
And was it 15?
It was 15, yeah.
15 and 49% mm-hmm. for the, yeah. So just, so close, right? But mm-hmm. it still half said no.
Yeah.
As opposed to just less than half said yes. So.
And I think you can imagine that in the 15 places, we're talking about probably fairly concentrated votes, you're probably looking at a highly informed electorate in those areas.
I'm going to say right in Charlottetown, personally, but I didn't actually see it. But that's the tendency. Because it was some commentary that I saw was that there seemed to be a lot of convincing going on that the farmers and the rural voters, and we'll talk about this a bit for Alberta, I guess, too, were sort of a bit weary of the Greens. Mm-hmm. They're still seen as not a big city party because Charlottetown isn't a big city, but people out on the periphery that have voted for a certain way for generations. A lot of the ridings, I don't know how many of the results you saw, if you analyze the numbers a bit deeper, there may have been vote splitting, but the problem is the Greens are such an unknown at this level and at this capacity, it's hard to say whether it was splitting. It'll take probably two or three elections to see whether it's people are leaning green because they're fed up with the conservative, whatever, right? But three-way is new territory, right?
There's an argument that could be made, I think, that for this was a change in election. People wanted to kick the Liberals out. They had two choices. I mean, because the NDP was a distant fourth.
They were not even the radar.
2,400 votes.
Total.
So they weren't even a consideration. So you're looking at either PCs or Green, and maybe you're someone who, and this is maybe where the polling falls apart, is, you've been talking in, responding in polls, talking about, maybe I'm interested in this Green guy, maybe not necessarily party, but maybe the Green guy in your area. And as you've sort of been hearing, and we kind of seen this backfire in the past, where the hype machine takes over and you're hearing Green government, Green government, Green government. And then you get to the ballot box and maybe you're like, I would have been interested in voting Green if it didn't seem like a certainty we were going to get a Green government. So then you throw your vote to the PC, because mm-hmm. I remember that happening in 1990 when the NDP got elected here, because so many people were fed up with Liberals and PCs, threw their vote to the NDP, and then when the NDP got a majority government, they instantly regretted it because they didn't think that was a possibility.
That's the election I was in.
Yeah.
That's another story as well.
We're just backtracking the truck up for those stories. But, and then the
as a Green, by the way.
So green, yes.
People don't know this maybe,
but
true story.
And then the other side of this too is Dennis King has been the leader of the PCs since February. Not February 2018. February 2019.
The February. Yeah.
They've had five leaders in 4 years. So
it's like Spinal Tap drummers.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So what does this party look like as it being able to form government? Perhaps King is sounding a bit more conciliatory because he knows that he's going to have a lot of uphill work to do because, 2 months ago he wasn't even in the head of the party. He was just, a guy. So
he's just a guy.
I think he was an MLA, but still.
Yeah, he's a known.
He's taken on that responsibility. Clearly the party has some stuff going on that they're going through leaders like their Defense Against the Dark Arts teachers. that'll be interesting to see too. And that, of course, puts the Greens in a prime position because now they are the heir apparents. So they have to capitalize swiftly if they want to prove they're ready to govern, perhaps more swiftly than most opposition parties.
Yeah, and there is a possibility here, because it's a minority government, that we would see some kind of confidence and supply arrangement between the Greens and the Liberals. It's not out of the realm of possibility. It just depends on how the PCs play it. Now, the Greens always say, as with this province and everywhere, they're willing to work with anyone to achieve their goals. So this PC government, or at least King, the way he's been speaking, sounds not concessionary, but the way he's been talking is like, yeah, I think maybe I can work with these people. He didn't specifically say the Greens. It could be the Liberals, either or. But Parliament has to sort of trundle on a little bit after they've gone to the governor or the lieutenant governor and said, yes, we want to be the government. And everybody says, okay, until which time it's not okay. So things have to play out a little bit more before we will know whether the Greens could potentially still become the government there. And also, like I said, there's one seat outstanding. Mm-hmm. So if that went to the Greens, they would have, would they be nine?
Nine.
Yeah, so the even stronger. 12 versus 9 is, in the scheme of things, is like, it's really close.
Yeah.
In the PEI scheme of things, maybe it's a bit further because they only have 27 seats. But it remains to be seen. So this is kind of a stay tuned sort of thing. It's like, we will definitely follow it because even though it's a little PEI, it's very, very interesting and will sort of prove where, I think it's going to be an echo of where, let's say, Canadian politics are going to go in the next, possibly the federal election, definitely provincial elections to come. We shall see.
All right. So speaking of provincial elections, Alberta had one last week. We've talked about that a couple times, too. Jason Kenney did take the most number of seats, was 63 out of 87. The former governing NDP are now down to 24. The Alberta Party, despite getting 9.1% of the vote, got zero seats. And I mean, it's. I'll make a case.
Welcome to First Past the Post.
Welcome to First Past
the
Post.
Here are the numbers. Yeah.
But I mean, this is the fascinating thing, that looking at the numbers, the UCP went up like just a little over 1%, or a little over almost 3%. That their tally went up, but they get all these seats. The NDP loses 8% and they lose, you know, 20 some odd seats.
Mm-hmm.
And then the Alberta Party gets 10% of the vote, almost 10% of the vote, and gets no seats. And it's like, I've never been like a dyed-in-the-wool sort of PR proportional representation person. But, you know, when you see numbers like that, it does make you think, like, if you can boost your your electorate by 3% and then you take over the whole province with kind of like no check and balance,
yeah,
that does seem a bit bizarre, especially when you have a party that gets 10% of the vote. And I've never been one to believe that your vote doesn't matter, even if your person doesn't win, because I find that's very defeatist and almost nihilistic in a way. But if you were someone who went out for the Alberta Party, I can understand how you feel today.
Yeah, and it's one of those things where people will throw out proportional representation until it doesn't suit them anymore. And when I say throw it, like put it forward, like, yes, this seems like a really good idea, there'll be some chit chat, and then it doesn't happen, because they know if you only need to work on 3%, let's say it's in every riding or in half the ridings or the ridings that you're strong, why the heck would you want proportional representation? Because these numbers would be, sorry, the number of seats would be completely different. What did you give the percentages of UCP with, like 55%? I mean, that's
UCP, yeah, 54.8% for the UCP, 32.7% for NDP, and then, as I said, 9.1% for the Alberta Party.
So just going by those hard numbers, you can't not have a majority with 55%. It's just, it's pretty much not possible unless, you know, all of the seats were slim margins between them.
And 70% voter turnout.
So. Yeah, which is supposedly higher for Alberta. There was a lot of indifference for years, but supposedly 70 is up. And again, the maps that they publish of the province, it's just pure blue. And you really got to, you have to zoom into Edmonton to see the orange seats. And I think there was three in Calgary. But, you know, if you were looking at it from Google satellite maps, you'd be, oh, man. But, yeah. So some might say that's not really a true reflection, too, if it's just that, oh, them city folk voting for those lefties.
Right.
And then the rest of the province is, yes, oil and pipelines and all that stuff. that they can't actually guarantee. I suppose that's another story, right?
Well, it's part of the story, right?
Because it's definitely part of the story, but
there's. And I heard Jen Gerson. I heard Jen Gerson talk about this on Canada Land, and you know, I don't necessarily like everything Jen Gerson says, but I find her perspective interesting. Mm-hmm. That you know, people in Alberta are feeling anxious. They haven't. Some of them haven't worked in years. They work in the you know the oil field. They're geologists or engineers or what have you, and the work just isn't there. They're desperate for change, and. In the wake of the NDP not being able to turn the whole province around and deliver pipelines and jobs where you get six-figure salaries, they you know, in their anger, they turned to the UCP. And this was a point made on a podcast I discovered, quite glad that I discovered it, called The Alberta Advantage, where it's a couple of politicos out in Alberta.
I think it's on iTunes as well. Yeah.
Yes, it, well, yeah. I'm
that's what I saw it on the Stitcher, on the ITV. ITV? Apple TV, yes.
It should have been ITV. Anyway, the Alberta Advantage, and you know, they're talking about how, you know, there's a lot of, you know, anger. A lot of people are, you know, that no matter how pro-pipeline Rachel Notley appeared, Jason Kenney was always going to be seen as the pro-pipeline guy.
It's that F-150 you've been driving around in,
right,
or whatever.
And Rachel Notley has been entirely pro-pipeline. And I've been saying this in conversations with people. It's like Rachel Notley couldn't get elected dog catcher running for the NDP in downtown Toronto or downtown Vancouver. She's too right-wing. She's too pro-pipeline, too pro-oil.
A heavy progressive veneer in all other areas.
Absolutely,
though, right?
But that's it's the damned if you do, damned if you don't situation. And Trudeau gets a lot of that too, is that the main NDP audience sees her as too pro-pipeline. The anti-NDP audience sees her as the radical lefty hippie Marxist gonzo crazy.
Yep, and the unfortunate the unfortunate extension to that is that she took a lot of
guff.
A beating online with that usual.
Oh, yeah.
We're not even going to go there, but I'm going to say alt-right for lack of a better blanket term, where they were just beating on her because she was a woman and all that other stuff. Death threats, I believe, something to the tune of at 1,300.
Yeah.
I'm fairly sure Kenny probably doesn't get that kind of stuff. However, there was something I happened to see the National Post wallpapers, picked it up for free. And there was a couple of articles they were complaining
that's
about.
That's why they're in financial trouble.
Hmm. There are a couple of articles complaining about something called Press Progress, which I believe is an arm of the Broadbent Institute. Anyway,
yes.
They're pretty much an NDP. I'm not even going to call them a think tank. But the harping that went on, do you know how many conservative think tanks that are out there that are just putting stuff out there?
Yeah, the Press Progress is partisan.
10 times
absolutely.
More.
But I mean,
Fraser Institute, blah, blah, blah. I mean, it's like you're whining about this, whereas half the stuff in the National Post, I think, comes from these think tanks and they just sort of put it out there. And Conrad Black, right? Well, he's writing about Notre Dame, actually. But even so, it's like, well, I guess he started the paper, but let's not talk about the National Post anymore.
But I mean, this is key because there are reports that people who are critical of Kenny had their Twitter account suspended the day before the election.
Yeah.
So what we're seeing is a weaponization using the tools of course, I've reported, you know, Donald Trump several times on Twitter. They haven't taken action.
Really?
There you go. Oh yeah, if he posts something that's like blatantly racist or blatantly harassment, or
I report Ontario Proud when it comes up in my Facebook feed as an ad, it's like I don't want this.
Yeah.
I really don't. Misleading or
but yeah,
false,
so
whatever.
So here we have Jason Kenney using the tools of stifle and dissent.
But free speech, Adam.
Well, that's the other thing is that
free speech.
These are the free speech people,
except for you and you.
Well, basically,
yeah.
But I mean, Press Progress is partisan, but they did incredible reporting in terms of exposing some of the quite horrid things that some of the UCP candidates have said in public on the record.
The poor white race and the things they suffer. Yeah,
yeah, and you know, your wife should only give you two things: respect and sex. Well, that sounds not so vaguely misogynistic. But to get back to Rachel Notley. There's a lot of people mad at her from the left, too. Not that they're issuing death threats, but this is something I learned on the Alberta Advantage podcast, is that these are progressive people, and they are pissed at Notley because they had 4 years, and one of the hosts said this, it's like everything that the NDP did is basically going to go away by September. Carbon tax, the tax
child
on wealthy.
Care,
well, childcare was part of their plank, but they were also ticked off because they didn't really talk about childcare, which should be a working class issue.
100%. Yeah.
It's things like the minimum wage increase. They can't necessarily repeal that because it's bad politics to take money away from people, but they're going to do everything they can to make that harder. They're going to do that with just changing regulations and things like that.
Well, it'll be like here, and we're going to get to Ontario too, and anything to do with the previous government just gets filleted but also stomped on.
Right.
As to what degree Kenny is going to do that, I expect a high degree. We don't know yet, but I would anticipate nothing less.
Well, he's also
than a trouncing of the record of that terrible government. What did he call them once? He called them the accidental government.
Yeah.
It's like I wouldn't say fighting words, but. Like, really? They were the government. Like,
well,
what are you saying?
It shows some disrespect. It shows them a lack of respect.
Yeah.
It also doesn't address the fact that the conservatives had, and this is a point I don't think was ever made, that the conservatives had 40 years. And, what do they do in 40 years? When the boom times are booming, everybody gets money. Everybody gets tax cuts. The money's coming in. We have so much money, we don't know what to do with it. And then the bust comes, and they're caught completely unawares. Nobody's saved for a rainy day, even though there's inevitably a rainy day. And it's everybody else in Canada's fault for not building the pipeline or not building or buying Alberta oil. And this is part of it, too. And Jim Prentice got a lot of crap for telling Albertans to look in the mirror. And this was another point I think Jen Gerson made when she was on Canada Land last week, that for years when oil was $100 a barrel and...
We're in the money.
Yeah, and you were making like high six figures working in the oil patch. Even if you were working at Tim Hortons, you were making like $20, $25 an hour. And there were so many people, mostly young men, who seeing all that money they could be made just working at Tim Hortons 40 hours a week... would leave school in grade 10, grade 11, grade 12, go start making money, and now they're out of work, they're angry, and they have nowhere else to put it other than looking to the woman in charge of the province. And instead of addressing that and saying, you know what, kid, maybe you should have thought about your future instead of how much money you can make, and maybe this is the fault of like our neoliberal... system.
Oh, yeah, yeah. I would completely agree with
instead
that.
Instead of like finishing high school, where then you can, the Sun Tzu quote, opportunities multiply when seized, right?
Ooh, I like that.
So it's, instead of looking at it that way, like graduate high school, because then more opportunities open up to you. Yeah, then maybe you can graduate high school, then go to work at Timmy's and make $25 an hour, but that's not always going to be there. Maybe you can go to university. Maybe you can learn like geology. Maybe you can learn green tech, something that's going to, because again, the point is, oil isn't going to be around forever. So we'll be back in a minute. You're listening to Open Sources Guelph. You're on CFRU 93.3 FM, CFRU.ca, Guelph Campus and Community Radio.
Obviously, a man that really doesn't need an introduction. That was Bruce Springsteen from his 78 album, Darkness on the Edge of Town. That was a song called Factory that he wrote for his father. And we played that because the day of mourning is April 28th, the day we remember workers who were killed and injured on the job, both in this province and in the country and around the world.
Although the flag racing is tomorrow at City Hall, and I think there's one on campus here
too. Yes, and then there's a flag raising on campus, and some guy named Scotty Hertz will be playing because he got the call up. So stop by. Why is this show all about me today? I don't know. It's
apparently.
It's 11:45, so come to the front of the center, and there's a ceremony. Half-mast. Anyway, on that note.
On that note.
Speaking of half-mast.
Oh, dear. So it's been busy times at Queen's Park. A couple of weeks ago, we had the budget. Last week, we had Mike Schreiner on talking about the budget, and Scotty was talking budget with Fred Hahn of QP. So the PCs have been doing what you usually do after budget, which is going around and promoting certain portions of it and trying to get the hype going. That has not come without some controversy of its own. Amongst them, news that they're going to be looking at amalgamating ambulance and ambulance services and dispatch centers. Among that, two cuts to the public health units. The City of Toronto alone is looking at a loss of about $1 billion in funding over 10 years. And it also means that the 36-some-odd conservation authorities across the province have lost 50% of their flooding funding to deal with floods. And guess what's happening right now up and down the eastern part of this province? Floods.
And so, what was the one I heard?
Excellent timing.
Yeah, and we're at the point where there's, you hear about different cuts every day. Today's was that tree budget was cut 50%?
The trees, 50 Nothing. Million trees. They've planted, I think,
it's something like half, right? 23 million?
Yeah, since 2008, they got halfway there, but apparently that's all the trees we're going to get.
Nothing sucks up flood water like trees, but you know, you never have enough in my book.
Or carbon in the air?
Exactly.
But yeah, so I mean, it's,
they don't create jobs, so we need to not plant
trees.
Them.
Don't create jobs.
No jobs. Well, except for the arborists, I guess. I mean,
yeah. Well, you know, I guess
trees are not job creators.
I guess if you think like a Smoggy or Doug Ford. But yeah, it's kind of galling. Like the flooding piece of this, and I saw somebody online make this comment. It's like, we get this news last Thursday or Friday that they're cutting the flooding.
It's always Friday.
Funding 50%, and then yesterday we have Doug Ford up in Bracebridge going like, "Hey, anything you guys need, just let me know." It's like, how about 50% of our anti-flood funding back?
Isn't that where his cottage is? The famous.
Yes.
Oh, okay.
Yes.
I missed that, but that's.
It's like, yeah. It's not in Bracebridge, but it's outside Bracebridge.
Because they would go there instead.
You better believe he was getting some. Actually, he wasn't putting out sandbags. He was definitely supervising some workers putting sandbags out.
They'd go there instead of going to Pride, right?
Yes.
Go hide out in Ford Nation North. Yeah, so I saw.
Or Winterfell, if you like.
Oh, our own jokes are funnier today for some reason.
Yeah. No.
So I happened to see some of the press conference in Toronto about the public health money, and Joe Cressy, NDP, saying, but also a municipal councillor saying, Torontonians will die. And of course, the government is saying, well, you know, he's overreacting.
Well, that's not the best part. An aide to Christine Elliott went down to City Hall and crashed it.
And he got chased.
And he got chased by the press.
Well, not chased. He ran away from the press because he didn't know what to say.
Want to add follow-up questions.
Rookie. And,
yeah, rookie move. Rookie mistake.
But how is this incorrect? How is this incorrect? And he ran into the elevator. God, that's the move that, like, Rob used to do. Yeah. Brother Rob, before he brained himself on the camera that one time. Classic stuff. He's missed, definitely.
Classic Rob blooper, yeah.
Yeah, so Elliot, of course, calling it fear-mongering, but, you know. It's only fear-mongering until the next SARS outbreak, and then it's, well, you know, we really don't have the staff to, you know, work on the outbreak.
It's not even, yeah, well, SARS is a good example because that came, like, right at the tail end of the Harris Eves years. It's not just that. You know, public health covers all kinds of things. Public health does the restaurant and grocery store inspections, like the tattoo parlor inspections, the massage parlor inspections, the pool inspections. That's part of public health's mandate. Public health is flu shots. So, you know, have fun next winter when half the city has the flu because there wasn't enough people to administer flu shots. I mean, so it's not just the big things. It's the little things that help sort of manage the public health issues in a city. Mm-hmm. And that's to say nothing about getting into like cutting nutrition programs, cutting breakfast programs, cutting library programs, which also happened this week. This was in Guelph today. The Guelph Public Library is ending interlibrary loans as of this Friday because the funding is gone. It's gone. So, you know, enjoy your... And, you know, maybe in Guelph it doesn't matter so much, where you could just, like, go take the bus or drive down the Westminster branch or...
But that, I mean, that's accepted practice of libraries for years, right?
But I mean, if you live in, you know, North Bay or, you know, someplace where you maybe have the one library.
With the one copy of whatever.
Right. Yeah. That's, you know, and that's doing unmitigated harm, especially when on top of that, they're talking about this e-learning thing and getting e-learning credits in high school. Well, where do poor people go to use the computer? Doug? And
I believe Doug actually said, oh, they can go to the library. Does he still say library? When he was a Toronto councillor, he said library all the time.
This is the thing that kills me is that he
needs to go to the library and study.
Hate on for the libraries. And it comes, I don't know where he gets informed.
Couldn't sell hash there. Oh.
I don't
the
know
views
where
expressed
he gets
on this program are not.
Information. But, you know, everybody's talking about libraries as, you know, cultural hubs now, as well used as they are. Go to the main branch of the Guelph Library. Go to any branch of the Guelph Library. It's constantly busy in there.
Absolutely.
And there's also the fact that, and people have talked about this, you have libraries filling the need of social services or gaps in social services. And one of them is computing, you know, applying for jobs, looking things up on the internet, doing e-learning, things like this. And I think Doug's problem is he hasn't been in a library in a while. And I don't say that in an insulting way. Like, how dare he not be a reader? I mean, it's okay if you don't go to the library every week as ritual. But at least know what you're talking about. At least understand what a library is and what it means to people in the 2019 context.
Again, when he was a city councilor, I believe he said something to the effect of he didn't care whether they were all gone.
Right, yeah.
Because I think the perception is library equals socialist. Anything that's for the greater good that you don't have to pay for, that no money changes hands and you pay for it with tax dollars, is considered inefficient and socialist. And that is the problem.
This is it, right? If you want a book, go buy it on Amazon. If you want a movie, go buy it on Amazon. You want a computer,
or get the e-book and
Best
use it on your device you don't have because you're poor. Right.
Yes.
And that the thing about – you mentioned e-learning too, and that's one of the – e-learning is sort of an extension – of a cut, or is a cut as well, because as we know, the more e-learning that goes on, and it's supposed to be four credits now at the high school level.
It's four.
Which, you know, how many teachers does that eliminate? Quite a few.
Yeah.
And of course, more news this week. Half of the high school teachers in what's called the Near North Board, which is North Bay, Nipissing, Parry Sound, just happens to be Vic Fedeli's writing.
Yeah.
Half the teachers got layoff notices up there. Lisa Thompson, the education minister, insists that no teachers would be laid off in the cost cutting.
Yeah.
Which is BS, really.
Well, and why are all these teachers going on Twitter talking about how they're
laid
no off?
I have no job, yeah.
That seems a bit bizarre.
It's weird. Just before showtime there, I saw that there's going to be a fund created to ensure that school boards aren't laying teachers off as a result of increasing class sizes to the tune of $1.6 billion. So it's like, we're going to cut a billion here and get rid of teachers. But then we're going to create a fund just to give the illusion and the impression that people aren't being laid off. There are layoffs.
Well, I mean, this is...
Not one person. No, sorry. Lots and lots of persons are being laid off
This is the three-card Monty of it. And we'll see this in the future with floods. And perhaps we underestimate the impact of floods given where we are. There hasn't been a really serious flood in Guelph in years. But there has been in the GRCA area.
Oh, yeah.
Just last year, there was that poor boy who was killed in the flood last year.
Mm-hmm.
And there's going to be a real bad flood somewhere. It's going to be completely unexpected. And it is going to call upon...
And so, on that note, topic
yeah, we'll
four.
Yeah, we'll have to leave Doug Ford.
Obviously, we'll be talking about Doug Ford
in
the future.
Yeah, he's not going to stop making news. Anyway, in the news south of the border, just before the Easter break, William Barr, so graciously, after a month it was delivered, released the Mueller report. It was redacted. to hide things like ongoing investigations, of which there seem to be 12 that we don't know about, 14 in total, two ongoing investigations that we are aware of, but 12 we are not aware of, or at least specific in terms of what they're investigating, and also things that protect the identities of people and keep the grand jury process a secret, and that's part of this as well. There's so much to unpack from it.
Oh my goodness.
That we wouldn't have the time, but I think the best part, and I was kind of reminded of it when I was rewatching John Oliver yesterday, was the line, and I think it was came from Gary Cohen, no, Don McGahn it came from, where he said, where Donald Trump is told about the special counsel, and he said, that's terrible, this is the end of my presidency, I'm effed.
Yes, it's too early in the day for us to legitimately swear on the air, but
yeah.
Very true, and McGahn has been subpoenaed, right, to appear before the House Judiciary Committee
soon? I don't know if he's been subpoenaed yet, but I know that Elijah Cummings has been threatening subpoenas.
So, this isn't over. Trump is doing these
over.
From the rooftops that, oh, no collusion, the collusion, delusion, and all these little phrases.
Total and complete exoneration.
Total, yes, exactly. It's like zero obstruction, zero collusion. It's like, well, no, hang on. There was no clear verdict on the obstruction. I saw at least 10 instances where they're like, no, this is actually, and one of them does involve McGahn, who was like, no, I don't really think I should break the law, so I'm not going to do this. It seems the main thing that's happening is that Trump is telling people to do things. The people that he tells them to knows that they're illegal,
right,
and they just don't do them.
Yeah, yeah.
But then, of course, there's other instances where the obstruction, he's telling me, okay, now, you know, Sessions, you should say this. And Sessions is like, I'm not going to say that. And and Sessions, interestingly, is one of the ones that's kind of dodged prosecution in this. There's a few people that were kind of left out, right?
Well, Sessions, he rightly recused himself early on.
Yeah, because he probably knew what was coming. Donald Jr., Kushner, and... for the time being, at least with that, the meeting with the Russians that fared pretty highly in this, Manafort was included with that. But of course, he got dinged on other things.
Mm-hmm.
He's off at Camp Cupcake or wherever the jail is.
Yeah, he's gone to prison.
Yeah. So
yeah,
it's not over.
Yeah, McGahn seems to be the
point person right now or whatever.
There was another incident where McGahn was in a meeting with Trump and a couple others, and he was taking notes, and Trump's like, why are you always taking notes? And McGahn's like, well, that's what I do. I'm a lawyer. When I have these meetings, I take notes. And Trump's like, I've noticed a lot of lawyers. I never take any notes. And it's like, well, okay, well, there's a red flag. There's a red flag.
He's suspicious of the notes. Like, burn those notes.
Like, I've been in board meetings where I've taken notes. I don't mean like as a journalist. I mean like as a participant, as like a member of the board. And, you know, you take notes. You take notes so you can remember things. I'm sorry, Donald Trump is apparently unaware of the base functioning of taking part in important meetings, which makes me wonder. Actually, it doesn't make me wonder at all, because we know that there are these times when Donald Trump has ordered someone to do something and it doesn't get done, and he kind of forgets about it until, you know, something rattles around in his head, and then he starts asking about it.
Yeah, because what was the one that was it in Woodward's book too about, I want you to assassinate the leader of Syria, and then somebody yoinks the piece of paper out of the pile? Or
I think you're confusing two things.
I may be, but they're similar.
He wanted to end NAFTA.
Yes, that's right.
He drew up the thing, or one of the free trade agreements. The thing was drawn up, and I think it was McGahn who went in and took it off the desk.
Just yoink out of the pile, and then we didn't hear about it anymore. The problem with Trump is that that's the kind of, he gets amped up about something. He's like, do this. And he wants everybody to do it. And then he forgets, maybe because he doesn't take notes. I don't know. So he loses track. And I guess he goes to bed and watches Fox News for 5 hours and gets, you know, thinks that NAFTA is a bad thing again. Or I should have a meeting with Kim Jong-un, which it seems Putin is getting the upper hand on that these days. I haven't really read too much about that.
No,
but Putin slid right in there.
Putin came out
he's
and
like,
said that Kim's ready to make some concessions. So there you go. Who knew? Who knew Trump and Putin would usher in world peace? Anyway.
unbelievable. Although it ain't over yet. But still, Putin's right in there, right?
Right.
Something about the man-spreading as well. I saw the picture. I was like, oh, guys. guys, you gotta stop doing that.
The other piece of this too is that the Russian interference part, mm-hmm. and there's been a lot of reporting this week about how Donald Trump, you apparently can't talk about this with him
because don't use the R word.
He takes it personally. And I mean, this speaks to the fact that he has this glass ego where you breathe on him and he shatters. But we have Russia threats, and this is one of the things that the report revealed, that Russia not only was hacking emails, but it seems like they were able to break into the voting machines in one Florida district. They were able to, like, they didn't change any votes or anything, but they, like, maybe
it's like
it was
a
like
test drive.
It was a test run to see if they could do it, and they found out they could do it. And that was one of those sort of underreported revelations. Everybody talked about I'm effed, but not many people talked about this portion of
All chads are dangling.
Right.
Yep.
So, you know, we have a dangerous situation, and even Christian Nielsen was like trying to get some movement on here, trying to address this. And Mick Mulvaney, acting White House Chief of Staff, says we're all like, yeah, don't bring up Russia. He'll freak out. And
you've caught him at a bad time. It's always a bad time.
It's always a bad time. But yeah, so you have the imminent threat of Russia. You have a presidential election happening in 18 months. And there's really seems to be no motivation on the part of the commander in chief to respond to an imminent and ongoing attack on the very foundation of American democracy, because he doesn't like being reminded that, you know, he managed to squeak out a victory in the greatest victory ever, the largest, that it was a squeaker, that he didn't win the popular vote, and he's been braying about it and huffing about it ever since, and he takes things so personally, and sometimes, especially when it comes to the national security of things, you can't take things that personally.
Yeah, it looks like they're going to let him huff it out until November 2020, because the word that keeps being brought up is impeachment. Is Trump going to be impeached?
Right.
It sounds like he isn't, and I don't know. I guess it depends on to what degree surfaces from everything from Mueller and everything else. It seems like the will of Congress might be there. And Congress has a lot more power than Mueller did. Mueller's job was to make the report, do the analysis. It's kind of like in Canada, we have all these committees where no one's really charged with anything. We're just going to talk about it. But it would be Congress's job to start the impeachment proceedings. And there's a possibility that they'll do that. But the problem is, when it goes to the Senate, or the challenge is that they'll never get enough senators, because they need two-thirds, like the supermajority, to push it through. And by the time the wheels start turning on that, it'll be November 2020. America won't necessarily have to worry about this. And the thing is, if Trump loses and he's no longer president, then they can really go after him. You're still Mr. President, but if you're not in the office and don't have the powers of the office, they can just tackle you.
With some of the things he's been accused of, he can be put in like he could get on Marine One. Marine One could fly to the mall, land on the mall, and then the police could put him in handcuffs on January 20th, 2021.
I think we're gonna see it. Personally, I think within our lifetime, we're going to see Trump in some kind of cuff.
Right. By nature, I'm a pragmatist. So, like, I would hear that, you know, the impeachment will basically go to the Senate to die. And under normal circumstances, I would say, okay, then, like, why bother?
And even if it is the smear job that he's talking about, at least it will, you know.
Under these circumstances, though, I feel like they have to do it. And there was a really interesting Fareed Zakaria special where it talked about, like, the weaponization of impeachment in American politics. But I think what that special was pointing to is, like, using impeachment that way has sort of watered it down. But I think they have to do it, especially when you think about William Barr being back in the picture now. William Barr is the guy who managed to get everyone out of Iran-Contra. When you have Iran-Contra, you had WMD in the Bush years. Mm-hmm. You had the market crash where no one went to jail. And now you have this. Someone has to go to jail now. There has to be consequences for these
And people
things.
Have gone to jail, but just not the top dog, right?
It's always peripheral people going to jail, right? It's like all the low-level non-com people went to prison. All the generals and colonels and stuff were A-OK.
Yeah.
But I think this is this is what people are rallying against, even if they don't really understand it, is the swamp. This is the swamp in action. This is the swamp encompassing everything. That if you are one of the top guys, you are protected. If you are one of the low-level people like Carter Page or Papadopoulos, or even, you know, somebody like Paul Manafort. Manafort is obviously expendable. He's not on the same level as, like, say, John Kelly or Donald Trump Jr. or Jared Kushner. So it's always the low-level people who suffer the consequences. And I think if impeachment doesn't go forward, that's just going to be codified. It's like we had this extraordinary situation where the president was obviously knee-deep and 35 different violations of norms, his responsibilities, and the Constitution of the United States, and nobody did anything, that is going to be a stink that is going to linger forever.
And that's our Donaldson moment for this week.
Anyway.
You do that so well.
Cool.
I have zero follow-up for that. That said it all. So.
All right. Well, let's wrap it up before we get another Amber Alert.
Yes. Not that we mind, but
that we mind, but we want to make sure that the Amber Alert gets heard. So if you want to find our show again, you can find us on our website, opensourcesguelph.com. Find us on Facebook at Open Sources Newswire or on Twitter at @OS_Guelph. If you'd like to listen to the show again, as I said, you can find it on our website every Monday, or you can get it from the Guelph Politicast channel on Podbean or download it on iTunes, Stitcher, Google Play, and Spotify. I'm on Twitter and Instagram at Adam A. Donaldson at G... No, I'm just at Adam A. Donaldson. Twitter and Instagram at it. I almost said my whole email.
Where
that's
are
fine.
You, man? Yeah.
And you can find my political site at guelphpolitico.ca.
Scotty Hertz on Facebook, Scotty Hertz on Twitter, and I blog at spannerbook.wordpress.com. And I have a podcast out there, but there may be some things on there in a week or two. I don't know.
Cool.
Things might happen.
Things might happen. Sounds like good promotion
that's
to me.
That's my new show. Things might happen. Right after Sounds Good to Me here at No. Coming up.
No,
is...
that's Nick's after Sounds Good to Me. Anyway.
Yes.
Stay tuned for DJ Sounds Good to Me here at the top of the hour on CFRU 93.3 FM, CFRU.ca, Guelph Campus and Community Radio, and we'll be back next Thursday at 5 p.m. for more Open Sources, and we'll see you then. We'll be right back.